Athens News Matters is sponsored in part by the WUGA Community Advisory Council, dedicated and involved individuals who help WUGA stay connected with our listeners, community organizations, and issues in the Athens area. Learn more at WUGA.org.
Today on Athens News Matters, lawmakers and the governor are starting to work on the state's budget.
The interesting thing is that the Department of Public Health isn't asking for new money. Necessarily any new money. And on the surface, that may seem like kind of a surprise.
We'll talk about what to expect with GPB's Stephen Fowler. This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. Also today, the Athens anti-discrimination movement expands its operations with a new justice center.
We don't just protest and rally for things. We also advocate for policy changes. And we also will go into the community and try to make tangible changes.
Plus, a historical look at the Trump presidency and an appreciation of poet Robert Burns.
Those stories, our panel on the weekend news, and more coming up on Athens News Matters.
Hours ago, halfway around the world, the day has already begun.
Tens of thousands of people in Venezuela.
Britain is leaving the European Union.
Everyone was just running. People were crying. They were in tears. And we didn't know what was happening. Police kept telling us to move back, move back.
The thousands of protesters marched along a route.
When you need to know where the world went while you weren't looking. Morning Edition. Listen every morning.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. The 2021 legislative session got underway last week, and this week lawmakers got to work in earnest on their biggest job, the state's budget. In his State of the State address last week, Governor Brian Kemp made his budget priorities quite clear.
Thanks to the passage of the CARES Act, conservative budgeting, and our measured reopening of Georgia's economy, our rainy day fund remains strong. Other states are looking at further cuts to employees and essential services. For aid, they're now forced to turn to a dysfunctional and distracted Washington, D.C. But because we acted swiftly and early, the budgets my administration will propose in the coming days include no new cuts to state agencies and departments, no furloughs, no widespread layoffs to state employees, and I might add no new taxes to pay for it all. But now, as we begin a new legislative session, our state still faces headwinds due to uncertainty in the global and national markets. But it is our job to till the earth, pass budgets that put hardworking Georgians first, and get ready for planning.
Here to talk about how budget negotiations are going and what the final product might look like is Stephen Fowler, political reporter for GPB News. Stephen, thanks for joining us today.
Always a pleasure, Chris.
Well, the budget process, regardless of the party in charge, has always been somewhat of a contentious thing. How close are the governor and General Assembly in terms of what they want to do with the budget?
Well, looking at the governor's proposal this year, it's really unchanged from how we passed the budget last year with all the cuts because of the COVID pandemic. And so this week, it's been the Joint Appropriations Committee hearing between the House and the Senate, where they heard the governor's presentation of his proposal and then heard from a bunch of state agency heads about maybe what they'd like to add in addition to that. And there's a really good quote from the hearings from Kelly Farr, who's the Office of Planning and Budget Director. And he said that the budget draft from Governor Kemp is flat like a crepe. And what he means by that is that most of the agencies in the state government are not going to get new money, or the proposals that they wouldn't get any more money than what they're getting in this fiscal year. Some notable exceptions there is education. K-12 education took a big hit, just like all the other agencies did with the pandemic, but they're going to restore about 60% of those cuts in the governor's proposal, and it compromises almost all of the new proposed spending for the amended fiscal year plan.
Well, K-12, that you already covered that. What about the University of Georgia? How will that sort of funding be impacted?
Well, there's going to be a pretty big increase in basic funding for the university system as well. Education is a priority of the governor and of the legislature. And when times are tight, That's been the one kind of sticking point that these lawmakers will continue to do, because other agencies have said they're able to make do with less or experiment with teleworking or other things like that. But when it comes to, you know, K through 12 education and post-secondary education, it's already not flush with cash. So lawmakers try to do what they can. Another perk in there is about $400 million for construction and upgrade projects on various school campuses. So that's what we're going to see in regards to higher education. And of course, all of this is contingent on what the House actually writes up in their version and what the Senate actually agrees to. And so this is kind of just chapter one of the budget conversations.
Sure. Well, with COVID-19 numbers on the rise, healthcare is certainly on the minds of many. What might the numbers look like for that in this new budget?
The interesting thing is that the Department of Public Health isn't asking for new money, necessarily any new money. And on the surface, that may seem like kind of a surprise, because we're in the middle of a pandemic and, you know, public health is an important thing. But what we're seeing in that agency, as well as the state government in general, is that there's been a lot of federal money that's come in, federal relief money, the CARES Act and other things that's really helping pay for a lot of these shortfalls and a lot of these extra work and things happening. And with the Department of Public Health, for example, some of the federal money comes with matching requirements from the state. And so while we're getting some help from, you know, Washington, D.C., there's others that we're not committing to because we just can't have the state provide more funds to match. So there is, you know, more coming for healthcare with the new Biden administration. Public Health Commissioner Dr. Toomey says she's looking forward to working with them to figure out a vaccine distribution plan, because she said on the healthcare front, Georgia has everything they need in place to roll out the vaccine, except for the actual vaccines. And that's not something you can necessarily appropriate enough money to do when it's things beyond your control.
Sure. Well, how good a job did lawmakers do at allocating funds and predicting the needs caused by the pandemic in the 2020 budget? I mean, will any changes need to be made, do you think?
Well, that's part of what the governor's message and the state economist's message and the Office of Planning and Budget Director's message is that the cuts Georgia made last year that were roughly, you know, $1.6 billion in cuts, put them in a position to kind of weather the storm of the pandemic and things that are happening. And some of it is creative accounting, in the sense that, you know, agencies eliminated positions that had been vacant for years and years and years and switched to teleworking because, you know, showing up to an office isn't the brightest idea right now. And so all that said, the reason we're adding some money back into the amended fiscal year budget, which runs until June 30th, is because the revenue collections have been better than they expected, because, you know, all of this is contingent on how much money the state actually brings in. But what remains to be seen is when tax season comes around, and a lot of people may be getting refunds because, you know, they had their taxes taken out based on them working for a whole year. And with a lot of people losing their jobs and such, there's probably going to be some volatility there. So they're trying to thread the needle between making sure that these agencies get enough funding to do their jobs, but not putting the cart in front of the horse and spending money that might not come in.
Well, that's a good segue into this next question. Kelly Farr, the governor's budget director, was quoted in the AJC saying, quote, "In uncertain times, we are creating a budget that gives a lot of certainty. I think it still gives the governor the flexibility to do what is necessary if revenues don't show up," end quote. What might this flexibility and certainty actually look like?
Well, I think it goes back to what Farr said in these hearings about it being flat like a crepe. You know, we made the state budget estimates. The governor made those estimates and the budget he signed last year based on kind of a worst case scenario of the economy being bad because of the pandemic. Right. And we know that it's better than it was then, So if you keep it at the level that it was at the height of the beginning of the pandemic, then you know you've got some wiggle room because right. you know that things have gotten better to some degree. But that flexibility comes from, you know, waiting to see what actually comes in. And that's why with the amended fiscal year budget, which is, you know, this last quarter of this fiscal year, it's going, the money is going towards something that is guaranteed, so to speak, of K through 12 education. And, you know, if things continue to be better, some other things can be slotted in. So that's the kind of flexibility that he's talking about.
Well, and speaking of those other things, I mean, certainly healthcare and education we've covered as main points of focus, but what other things should people be looking out for with the state budget?
Well, one of the big priorities that the governor has mentioned throughout his term, and especially this year, is investment in rural Georgia. There is going to be dedicated money in this amended budget and next year's budget to help continue to roll out access to rural broadband. That's been a long-term project for lawmakers in the state to figure out. There's going to be money for a rural innovation fund that is going to be paired with this strike team that he's put in place to continue to get investments and jobs and companies coming to Georgia outside of the metro Atlanta area.
Right.
That's been a big focus because while metro Atlanta is a big economic driver of the state, there's, you know, still plenty of jobs and employees and people outside of that area. And it's a focus that the governor and the legislature has continued to have. And there's money for that as well. And transportation and infrastructure is not necessarily the hottest of topics and one that gets a whole lot of debate, but there's more money there to improve upon the infrastructure across the state as more people and more businesses continue to come here.
That's Georgia Public Broadcasting's Stephen Fowler. Stephen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Betsy Bean, publisher of Boom Athens Magazine. When I launched Boom, I knew I was writing for a serious, engaged audience, and I guessed that my readers listened to WUGA, as I do every day. I thought we would be a natural fit, and that's proved true. In a word, WUGA gives Boom cachet. Find out how you can become an underwriter by emailing wuga@uga.edu.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley. And here today to discuss the week in news and politics are Gwen O'Looney from WXAG, Blake Odd from Flagpole, and Lee Shearer, retired veteran journalist, formerly with the Athens Banner-Herald. Thanks so much for being here today. I appreciate everyone as always. Let's start with COVID cases. It seems that they are just getting worse and worse in Athens. Blake, as you well know, Flagpole reported this week that 88 hospital beds were in use out of the normal capacity of 70. Do we know what that means in practical terms?
Well, those are intensive care unit beds. The ordinary beds are over 90% capacity, so that's a very high number as well. You know, we're working on getting some more information about this from the hospitals, but I can only assume they've opened up a new ICU floor, at least one of the hospitals has. So over 40% of these patients are COVID patients, so that's really what's driving this. We topped 10,000 cases for Clark County a week ago. That's not even including the antigen tests that aren't included in the confirmed totals. So it's really more like 12,000, which means 10% of the Clark County population now has gotten COVID. So that's a grim milestone for us.
And a long way from herd immunity. But the tide appears to be ebbing a bit around here. And we're in Clark County are lucky in some ways. We have one of the lowest death rates in the state. And our incident rate right now is much lower than, say, Jackson County, which was leading the state in the two-week incident rate recently. Just be glad we're not in rural Georgia. I saw an analysis where if you considered rural Georgia a separate country, it would have the fourth highest COVID death rate in the world.
Part of that is Clark County has skews very young because of the university population. And of course, the disease tends to not be as serious for younger people as older people. So I think that's part of the reason that we have such a low mortality rate, you know, which is a great thing. But all of these counties, these rural counties, feed into the Athens hospitals. They have a basically a 10 county coverage area. So what goes on in Jackson County contributes to the situation at the hospitals in Athens.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was just going to say there are some optimistic things. I mean, some positive things in that. They've done a great job with the 65 and older. People are coming from other areas to try to get shots and vaccines in Athens, Clark County. And our health department has a lot to be proud of. They're doing an excellent job. But we just need more vaccine available in more places. But the capacity that they're showing is impressive.
So let's move on now to the Mayor and Commission approving a $250,000 settlement of an excessive use of force lawsuit. That was for the shooting of a man in October of 2019 by the ACCPD. Do we know how the Commission came to this number?
Well, I'm sure it was out of the recommendation of the insurance company, related to the request that came from the, the family primarily is what brought this suit.
I think it's mostly, like Gwen said, the insurance company, because they're covering most of this. Athens Clark County has a $100,000 deductible. That's all they're on the hook for. So, you know, the insurance company is going to say, hey, you know, this is the amount of money we're willing to eat to avoid the risk of going to trial and having to pay much more. This case was the man's name was Salazar, and he was shot. He swung a machete at an officer, and the officer shot him. He filed a lawsuit, basically saying that the police had no reason to be there in the first place because they got a call about a domestic dispute from his girlfriend, but. That no crime was really being committed, and that the officer escalated the situation by pulling his gun and had no reason really to be confronting Salazar. And of course, then, you know, the guy pulls out a machete, but, you know, the argument is that, you know, the situation never should have gotten to that point in the first place. He's been in long-term medical care. He suffered some very serious injuries and has essentially been hospitalized ever since.
Well, let's stay with law enforcement, sort of, but we're moving to Oconee County now, where Sheriff James Hale told the Oconee Enterprise that he has some serious disagreements with new policies put in place by the new DA, Deborah Gonzalez. What's the nature of his disagreement, and how does this contribute to our understanding of Watkinsville Mayor Bob Smith's request to create their own judicial circuit?
Just look at the last election and last two elections, the votes, and you'll see the difference in philosophy between Athens Clark and Oconee. Deborah Gonzalez represents a new look at our justice system. The Western Circuit that we're in only includes the two counties. And of course, Bob Smith's suggestion is totally out of line with the organization of the state and the criteria that's used for setting up the districts. But Bob Smith is not an authority on anything.
What is the sheriff's disagreement with Deborah? Have you heard anything about the sheriff's disagreements with Deborah's policies that she's enacting?
Well, she's not going to seek the death penalty, and she is not going to charge low-level drug offenders who have drugs for their own personal use. Sheriff Hale in Oconee County doesn't agree with that. He thinks that there are cases where the death penalty should be applied, and that they're going to continue to arrest low-level drug offenders, you know, people with small amounts of marijuana and so forth, you know, but there's not really anything he can do. He can arrest anybody he wants, but that doesn't mean the DA has to charge them. These are both elected officials and they're independent, and they can, you know, within the guidelines of the law, they can do what they want. They have discretion. So, I mean, it's Sheriff Hale's opinion, but it has no bearing on what Deborah Gonzalez can do or not do as district attorney.
Doesn't have much effect on her ability to do her job, would you say?
No, none whatsoever. I mean, it just means she's going to have a lot of cases to dismiss that Oconee County is going to bring her that, you know, she's going to throw in the trash.
Yeah, so. He can increase her workload.
Yeah.
By doing that.
Let me just say that if you read nationally the state of the art, the trends that are developing across our country, Deborah Gonzalez is in line, if not maybe totally, a little bit more comprehensive, but she's not doing crazy things. She's doing things that have been really looked at and felt to be the way we should be moving with our law enforcement systems.
And things that will save taxpayer money. Keep that in mind as well.
Yeah, that's a good point, Lee. And one thing that conservatives should like about Deborah Gonzalez is that anytime that she recommends a prison sentence, she's going to include the figure of how much it's going to cost taxpayers to incarcerate that person.
That's great.
So we're going to know the cost of keeping people behind bars, which is very
important. We should always keep in mind that Georgia is the number one state in the nation for having people under judicial supervision. Probation, it's a big industry, big money-making industry.
Let's try to touch on the fact that our new Georgia senators, John Ossoff and Reverend Raphael Warnock, were sworn in Wednesday afternoon. How much leverage can we expect for them to have with the Senate now split 50-50 between Democrats and Republicans, with Vice President Kamala Harris as a potential tiebreaker?
Well, you know, they are freshman senators, so they're not going to be huge influencers of the entire Senate. But with every vote they cast, if they are supportive of the president, we'll have a much better chance of that our president succeeding to move things forward.
Yeah, like Wayne said, I mean, every vote is important because you can't even lose one. The guy I think that gives the most power to, though, is probably Joe Manchin from West Virginia, who's the most conservative Democrat in the Senate, and he's the one who you're probably going to have to convince.
And that's our time for this week. Thanks to my guest, Blake Odd from Flagpole Magazine, Gwen O'Looney from WXAG, and Lee Shearer, formerly with the Athens Banner-Herald.
I'm James Menendez. In a time of fast-developing news and headlines, NewsHour is there to help you make sense of a complex world.
This is an historic victory and what is a very important day.
This could change world history.
Everybody's going to pay a price. You will, everybody will.
And I am just so happy to be home and to put my feet on this land again.
Again, another huge development.
That's NewsHour from the BBC.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. The Athens anti-discrimination movement has grown in a very short time to become an important voice for social justice in the Athens community. Last week, the organization opened a new justice center to continue its mission. I spoke to the AADM's president and co-founder, Mocha Jasmine Johnson, about the center and what it provides.
We're going to open our Justice Center and bookstore. This facility is going to address people that are dealing with mass incarceration and support for knowing how to protect their rights, and also a safe space for the youth because we will host our teen social justice program there. And we know there's COVID-19, but mass incarceration is also still an issue that needs to be addressed.
And so you're serving multiple purposes for the community.
Mm-hmm. We started a bailout program. We also started a community service program. We're offering tutoring during COVID, and we've been able to touch a lot of people's lives. We don't just protest and rally for things. We also advocate for policy changes, and we also will go into the community and try to make tangible changes. We saw where we could help people get back on their feet and to be more productive in a restorative approach. We want people to know that there's a place that they can go to get some real help.
And you mentioned that bailout. Is that a fund that you help people get out of jail with, Mocha?
Yes. Yeah, so basically the bailout fund started back over the summer when we had the Justice for Black Lives protest. People were getting incarcerated for peacefully protesting. So we started the bailout fund, and then we also were able to help other people to get out of jail. So where we also really see the need is once they get out of jail, it's like dealing with the legal fines and fees so they don't end up going back into jail. And even during COVID-19, we have helped to house families that have nowhere to go, pregnant moms, caught up for things as traffic tickets and not working right now, and then have to show up for court and don't have the money. We're helping people out like that. So it's not as people look at it and be like, well, they commit the crime, you know, they should be locked up. It's not that straightforward and simple.
Right. So if they can pay the fines, basically, they can keep their lives.
Right. Exactly. Once you are incarcerated, there are court fees and fines that are in place. So now you have a debt. So you are leaving jail with a debt. And when COVID-19 hit, there were still people out here that needed to complete their community service. And there were facilities open and available for that. So we created an online-based program to where people were able to complete their community service, still be involved in a community, and then also provide some support in different ways when it came to court fines and fees.
Yeah, that you don't even think about that. If you haven't had a brush with the system, if you're fortunate, you don't realize that it's not just, oh, I paid my bail, I'm good. There are other things involved that mm-hmm. you might not have the resources to deal with.
Right, especially during these times when people weren't working, and it's better to help people to get back on their feet so they can be productive members of society as opposed to struggling and not having enough resources, because then that could possibly lead to a life of crime. You know, poverty is tied to crime. It's like a horrible, like, spiral effect, because if you're born into poverty, you cannot say that I created that for myself.
Right.
Right. When you're pulling yourself up by your bootstrap, you do have some type of assistant or at least a strong support system. Some people are lucky that they're born into a family of wealth and privilege. That's help. Some people are lucky that they're born with a different skin tone. That is also help. You know,
privilege.
Depending on what skin tone that is. Right. So people don't see those things.
Right.
So I'm hoping that this Justice Center, you know, it is here in Athens. It is going to be based out of Athens, but I see us being able to serve people not just within Athens, but within the surrounding areas as well in the royal towns.
And is this going to be available on Zoom or later or something, where you have it available maybe on your website or Facebook page?
Yeah, we're going to we're doing a recording, and we're going to release a small documentary. People will be able to see not just the office, but some of the work that we've been doing.
And Mocha, tell me a little bit about how people can support your mission.
You can visit aadmovement.org, click on the donation button, and also volunteer their time. And we're accepting book donations.
Thank you so much, Mocha.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
With kids learning remotely and daycare facilities shutting down, frustrated parents have done their best to juggle working from home while taking care of their children. But women seem to have even more to worry about than their male counterparts, as a recent study found. Women provided most of the child care during the COVID-19 shutdown. Here to provide us with a little more detail about her study is Kristen Shockley, an associate professor of psychology at the University of Georgia. Thanks for stopping by Athens News Matters today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's just kick things off by telling us a little bit about what inspired you to conduct this study in the first place.
Well, when the pandemic started back in March, my son was 15 months old. Oh, wow.
Yeah. And we got the news that daycare was shutting down. And I started thinking, wow, what am I going to do? Right. And if I'm facing this struggle, there must be a lot of other people in the same boat. And started talking with some colleagues. And then we decided to try to get a study launched.
How about that? Well, let's just get right into some of the specifics. What were some of the findings?
Yeah, so we found couples that were, both members of the couple were still working during the pandemic, but had a kid that was under age 6 and their normal childcare was disrupted. And I should say these were all heterosexual couples. We had both members report, what are you doing? We did, how are you handling this? How are your job and home responsibilities changing? How are your spouses? And then we followed up with these couples on average about 7 weeks later and looked at some well-being outcomes like sleep, job performance, and some marital tension.
Well, as a parent of children who are now grown, I can attest to that is definitely, that is the most high stress part of parenting usually occurs during those ages.
Yeah, that's exactly why we focused on that age group.
Well, how is the overall family affected when the woman takes on all of the childcare responsibilities?
Yeah, so in 22.2% of these couples, the wife was doing all of the childcare. And in an additional 9.6%, she was doing most of it. And when we looked at those outcomes, it was, as you would expect, when the wife is doing it all, it's not great. It's not great for the marriage. It's not great for the wife's job performance, which is not surprising, right? But it's also, this is kind of interesting, not great for the husband's job performance either. Even though, you know, his work hasn't really changed, our speculation was that it's just the tension created at home.
Yeah, he feels the stress. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So pretty much across the board, that was the worst group you could be in. But that was our most frequent category.
Well, what strategies did you find parents could use to ensure that childcare is more of an equal effort for those working remotely and also for those who are not working remotely?
Yeah, so we found when both people were working remote, two egalitarian strategies tended to emerge. So you had couples who we called these the planned mini shifts. So this was people who would say, okay, I'm going to work from 8 to noon, and then you're going to work from 2 to 6. And then we had other couples we called the need-based alternation. And sometimes they'd have a rough plan. You know, they would really switch it up based on their work needs as well as the kids' needs. But we saw some slightly better outcomes for that need-based alternation. And I think that might have to do with, it just requires a lot of communication. And then people who weren't working remote, the best strategy that was egalitarian was alternating working days. And I think this only works for a certain type of job, but these people were really segmenting. So it was, okay, Monday you're working, Tuesday I'm working. And they had good performance, good sleep outcomes.
Well, this phenomenon seems like it stems from the way our society is structured. How can the average person work to change the stereotype that women should be the primary caregivers?
You know, we've seen a lot of changes with women in the workforce making huge strides, and we've seen some changes with men at home, but it's just not at the same pace. And so I think we need to push more for the cultural acceptance that it is your role as a dad to be an active parent. So if you can shift to a kind of a team mindset and prioritize both people's careers, I think that's what we really need to see true change. And then, of course, we don't have a lot of structural support in our country. I think it's a multifaceted problem.
Absolutely. Well, Kristen Shockley is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Georgia. Thanks for stopping by today.
Thank you.
Born in 1759, Robert Burns is considered one of the great poets of Scotland. But who was Robert Burns, and why is he so important to Scottish culture? Joining us today to talk about Robert Burns, as well as the upcoming Burns Dinner, is UGA's Georgia Power Professor Emeritus Ian Harden, or as I prefer to refer to him, Sir Ian the Red. So I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar with Robert Burns, but for those that may not be, give us a little overview of Bard Burns, highlighting, if you could, some of the reasons he's had such a lasting impact on poetry and literature, both in Scotland and around the world.
Well, yes. When they did a vote just a few years ago, he beat out William Wallace as the most important Scot of all time. Referred to as the Scottish Bard, he had a short life. only about 37 years old, but his poetry is still a part of all of our literature that's written mostly in English, a lot in Scottish dialect, all over the world. On January 25th, or some day close to that, there are Robert Burns dinners. So you can go to Shanghai, Beijing, Moscow. In fact, I will be sending a video to the St. Petersburg, Russia Burns Club this weekend, because they will be hosting a dinner, and they will have videos from me and people in Australia, New Zealand, so forth. So he's celebrated all over the world.
Tell us a little bit more about the Burns Supper and the ever popular Scottish delight haggis. I mean, how did this come about?
Well, I think probably it got started in the early 1800s after his death in the late 1700s. And every Burns Supper, or Burns Dinner, as we call it over here, follows a particular sequence. And the first is you have piping, and then the haggis is brought out, and then the master of ceremonies slices through the haggis, opens it up, and also reads the poem Ode to a Haggis by Robert Burns. And the rest of the program there is very much laid out. So in New Zealand, they will do the same thing that we will do here in Athens. We will honor him. We'll have an ode to the lassies, a reply to the laddies, and a number of readings of Burns' poems.
Well, Robert Burns was also a vocal supporter, was he not, of the American Revolution and the French Revolution? How did that affect his writings and his life?
But yes, he was in favor of he followed the American Revolution and the French Revolution. And one of his poems, A Man's a Man for All That, which is one of the possible Scottish national anthems, he actually published that anonymously in Dumfries, where he lived, because it could have put him in jail.
Well, tell me, if you would, what are some of your favorite passages of Burns' writings? Can you recite a few for us, even?
Yes. In fact, two of his poems are among the three that might be chosen for a Scottish national anthem. One of them is A Man's a Man for All That. Another is Scots Wha Hae, which also has been put to music. And this is where Burns has written a poem imagining the address of Robert the Bruce to his troops before the Battle of Bannockburn. My favorite is the one that Lincoln actually started reciting just a week or so before his death to a mouse. We sleek at cowering, timorous beastie. Oh, what's a panic in thy breastie? That need not start away so hasty with bickering brattle. I would be loath to rend and chase thee with a murdering pattle. I'm truly sorry man's dominion has broken nature's social union and justifies that ill opinion which makes thee startle at me, thy poor earth-born companion and fellow mortal.
Ian Hardin is Georgia Power Professor Emeritus from the University of Georgia and a good friend of the station. Ian, haste you back.
I'll be back again. Okay.
And all that is coming yet for all that. But man to man, the world o'er, shall brothers be for all that.
Every day, NPR's All Things Considered includes news that keeps you ahead of the curve.
If this issue is not important enough for us to draw a line in the sand, what issue is?
Plus, the unexpected.
The wing, the skin, the neck, the heart, you're making chicken meatballs, cooking the knee cartilage.
All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. Nearly half of Americans consider Donald Trump to be one of the worst presidents in U.S. history, according to recent polling data from PBS NewsHour, NPR, Marist. As Trump's presidency takes its place in the history books, will historians agree with public opinion and rate Trump as one of the worst, or will history tell a different tale? Here today is our resident historian, Dr. James Cobb, Emeritus Spalding Distinguished Professor of History at the University of Georgia. So welcome back to Athens News Matters, Dr. Cobb.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
A number of presidents have been considered the worst, James Buchanan comes to mind, or perhaps Herbert Hoover, who presided over the beginning of the Great Depression. In the pantheon of presidents, where would you place Donald Trump?
Well, you know, presidents whose terms you have experienced, you know, you see more vividly and oftentimes more critically. I would say probably Donald Trump is the worst in American history, you know, based on what I know as a historian, what I've experienced in living 73 years.
That's a pretty bold statement. can you tell us why you say this?
Well, I think because you know, he's just an extraordinarily bad person to start with, and when you put a bad person in a position of such power, and particularly when the circumstances, the interactions he has with other branches of the government, but more importantly with other people in the branches of government. And so we had a perfect storm with Trump in that he goes into office in an extremely partisan, bitterly partisan context, and highly partisan enablers who both fear him and wish to curry his favor, who make him, I mean, they magnify all of the problems arising from his own character deficiencies. So he came into a context that was most conducive to making his impact more negative than perhaps it might have been otherwise.
Well, there's certainly a difference in how those of us living in the moment evaluate the Trump presidency compared to how historians and future generations looking back might see it. As historians start to grapple with this moment in our history, what factors do they look at in evaluating the overall impact of the Trump era?
You mean you look at where the country was when the president is inaugurated and where it was when he left office, and then some of the things that it's hard to say right now. We don't have enough perspective to say, you know, what his, you know, very different approach to trade policy, you know, what was it, what did it actually bring about in the short run, in the long run? And, you know, there frankly are things that Trump has done on, you know, on trade that you know, they may turn out to have been more positive. So a lot of people think they already appear to be positive contributions. But, you know, the whole, in this particular case, the pandemic kind of blows a lot of fog in over any kind of evaluation like this, because you have no idea what would have transpired without it.
Recently, we've heard calls for the country to unify, but we've also heard that there cannot be unity without accountability. Can you point to a time in history when the country was this divided, and how does it compare to what we're experiencing now?
Well, I mean, you know, anybody who's spent much time reading American history knows that, you know, there were some pretty bitter partisan divides over the course of our, you know, emergence and growth as a nation. There are cases, you know, the Jacksonian era, for example, where it's just bitter, awful, you know, ad hominem attacks on the opposition. And so, and you look at how that filtered down to a Whig or a Democratic newspaper, or, you know, in a state or area that was, you know, heavily committed one party or another. You know, it was really very, very, very bitter. But of course, the you know, we didn't have the internet and instant news reporting and what have you to make that all come alive for us and make us fully aware of the extent and the severity of the divisions. So you know, it's really difficult to say. You know, if we had the internet in the 1830s and 40s, you know, we might think, well, you know, what we're looking at right now is maybe not as severe as we think. But it's certainly shocking. We never, you know, there clearly is no record of any sort of assault on the seat of government, such as we saw on January the 6th, and which I guess is one of the most sobering, shattering events in recent U.S. history.
Well, finally, given the division in the country, where do we go from here?
Well, you know, I think it'll, you know, they're both parties will be feeling each other out for the first 2 years till we get to the midterms for sure. And I think it's such an, you know, even though the country is bitterly divided, the legislative branch is fairly evenly matched. And I think, you know, a lot is going to play out in Congress, you know, in my opinion, if Biden could just undo half of the mess that we're in right now in the next 4 years, he will have performed brilliantly and rendered a tremendous service to this country. But to expect that he has really been able to install any enduring initiatives of his own and have them, you know, start to be functional and effective, that will be a huge challenge on top of the huge challenge he already faces.
Well, Dr. Cobb, as always, we appreciate your insight.
Well, I'm sorry I flooded you with insights, I think, today.
Dr. James Cobb is Emeritus Spalding Distinguished Professor of History at the University of Georgia. You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. Our producers are Martin Matheny, Jean Davis, Emma Turner, Lucas Trevor, Megan Wand, Devin Zwald, Jessica Wurst, and Isabella Liu. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia.
As always, you can listen back to today's stories and all of our stories on our website at wuga.org or on the WUGA mobile app available for Apple and Android. And of course, we'd like you to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at WUGA-FM. For Alexia Ridley, I'm Chris Shoup, and this has been Athens News Matters from WUGA News. We'll be back next week with more, and don't forget, if you're going out in the public, wear a mask and practice safe social distancing. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.